This talk was given by Danica Shoan Ankeley at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shoan is a senior monastic in the Mountains and Rivers Order. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation or find out more about our retreats and residency programs, visit our website at zmm.org. Thanks for listening.
Okay, so I wanted to talk about that was all just patter, okay? What I really wanted to talk about is quenching the thirst. Quenching the thirst. And not by tearing it up by the roots or papering over it or getting rid of it, but by actually taking a long, cool drink from the well of reality. Desires may be inexhaustible, but that's just because we've got a screwy framework. They're actually completely satiable. Right at the root. So I want to start with a passage from Tar Baby by Toni Morrison. And I really wanted to bring Toni Morrison into the Zendo. Because she was such a great creative being and speaker of truth. And as I'm sure most, if not all of you know, she died just a couple of weeks ago at the ripe age of 88. So she was a novelist and a professor, teacher, I would add a mystic, a shaman, a healer. And truth isn't bound by religion. It's just truth. That's what makes it truth. It's truth. So you can find it expressed by anyone who really wants to see and who is studying life and reality in a genuine way. So this is a jumping off point from Tar Baby. At some point in life, the world's beauty becomes enough. You don't need to photograph, paint, or even remember it. It is enough. No record of it needs to be kept, and you don't need someone to share it with or tell it to. When that happens, that letting go, you let go because you can. The world will always be there. While you sleep, it will be there. When you wake, it will be there as well. So you can sleep, and there's reason to wake. A dead hydrangea is as intricate and lovely as one in bloom. Bleak sky is as seductive as sunshine. Miniature orange trees without blossom or fruit are not defective. They are that. So the windows of the greenhouse can be opened, the weather let in. The latch on the door can be left unhooked, the muslin removed, for the soldier ants are beautiful too, and whatever they do will be part of it. In the book, the greenhouse, the image of the greenhouse is used as a sort of the obsession and passion of one of the characters who is really using it to try and control his life in a sense. And because the people and situations and relationships of his life are completely out of his control. And then as the book goes on, that greenhouse kind of descends into wildness. So reality can't be controlled. And the basic mistake that so many of us make is that we all make, unconsciously, I guess, is that to try and find happiness or peace of mind, we try to set things up and control things. And I think for a lot of us, you know, Zen practice can just be one more attempt. One more attempt. But actually, Toni Morrison has it just right. When that happens, that letting go, that release into seeing that the beauty of the world, just as it is already enough. That word, thirst, tanha, that craving, we have to really see how fundamental that is to how we're living, and to really see how futile it is, just on a very basic level. And to see how the grasping, clinging, controlling mind is just always at the ready. So Zazen's like an incredible, kind of brutal practice sometimes, to just sit there and like take that in. And letting go is so weird because you can't force it, right? Just let go already. I have looked, as I'm sure you all have also, at, you know, when my mind is really turning or really caught in thought, I try to see, like, what's underneath? Like, what's driving this whole thing? Like, what am I, like, sitting here trying to do, you know? And I have seen that, like, there's a basic feeling of wanting some kind of resolution. I don't know if you can relate to that, but that, like, underneath all of the thinking, like, I'm trying to, like, resolve something. Like, just, like, take care of it, you know? And whether I'm thinking about, like, I don't know, whether the windows should be open or closed, or whatever, like, there's a, like, deeper longing to just, like, quench that thirst, that churn, that need. But of course, it's fairly basic to see that as long as we're looking for something to satisfy our desire that's outside, it's a broken situation from the get-go. It's a setup. Because as we know, and if we don't know, we learn, life teaches us, everything's impermanent. Rupert Gethin, who's a Buddhist practitioner and scholar, writes, "Our craving is based on a fundamental misjudgment of the situation, a judgment that assumes that when our craving gets what it wants, we will be happy, that when our craving possesses the objects of its desire, we will be satisfied. But such a judgment, in turn, assumes a world in which things are permanent, unchanging, stable, and reliable. And the world is simply not like that. Try as we might to find something in the world that is permanent and stable, which we can hold on to and thereby find lasting happiness, we must always fail. It's not working. It's never worked. It's not going to work." When Toni Morrison writes, "The beauty of the world is enough," here I take beauty in like that deepest sense. So beauty as like truth, you know, beauty as like the inherent perfection, beauty as the way that everything is already enough, just as it is. So that's the only way to quench your thirst. The poem on the faith mind says, "The great way is not difficult for those who have no preferences." The great way, the perfect, enough beauty is easy. It's easy. It's already there. What's the catch? It's easy for those who have no preferences. Another translation says, just avoid picking and choosing. So to take the world on its own terms, without exception, that's the catch. When we actually learn to see what's here before us, it's a religious experience. Our thirst is quenched. That's the sense of completion, or you can call it God or divinity. And it could be in a dead hydrangea or in a scrap of cardboard. A thing. You could see it in a thing. It doesn't have to be seen outside in a thing. When Morrison writes about the dead hydrangea and the bleakness of the sky, it reminded me, a friend gave me a book on wabi-sabi. And this is, it's probably a familiar term. I think it's kind of entered the popular lexicon, but it's a Japanese aesthetic of appreciating what is imperfect, what is shows signs of impermanence or wear, what is incomplete. So, you know, the classic example is like the broken teacup, where you see the crack or the chip. And then there's the story of the monastic who's like preparing the tea house for a guest and takes care of everything and cleans it so perfectly. And then the master comes and takes a look and says, "Just one thing." And she shakes a tree, so just a few leaves fall on the path. Now, perfect. Wabi, the word wabi, I guess has connotations of like alone, lonely, despondent. And sabi, cool, chill, withered. But apparently, it's like kind of an untranslatable phrase. To me, it feels like, oh, it's like the beauty of like what is tender and vulnerable. So the bleak sky, the dead flower. And I was thinking of this and kind of letting it arise for me during Sesshin and letting it bring me in closer. You know, not that I have a handle. I think it's like an actual, like there's an aesthetic and people study it and da-da-da-da-da. I just mean like in my little like lowly kind of, you know, everyday practitioner mind kind of way, being like, oh, like, wow, like, you know, seeing a thing the way the paint chips off and being like, ah, oh, letting my mind rest with that, to appreciate it, to come into contact, letting its beauty be enough. And, you know, then you can extend that and think like, oh, like I'm wabi-sabi imperfect, tender, vulnerable. Like, ah, that's beautiful. Like our wabi-sabi monastery. Imperfect, tender, flawed. It's beautiful. When we say impermanent, you know, we know, like, okay, yeah, impermanence, sure. We get old, we're gonna die, mountains crumble, things come and go. But then there's impermanence that's so close, so close. No substance whatsoever. I was thinking about, how the mind has to be quiet in a certain way to appreciate that subtle beauty. And I feel like I am more drawn, sort of more by nature, drawn to like the bold and the like, less subtle manifestations of beauty, shall I say. And I was remembering a number of years ago when I was Mountain Record editor, and we did an issue on impermanence. And the way that the Mountain Record cover would be selected is we would choose a range of images, and then send them all to Roshi, and Roshi looks and then chooses one. And I think Mujaku Senjin was the graphics and layout person working with me on this issue, and we had a bunch of images. And one of them I really like didn't get at all. And of course, that's the one that Roshi picked. And later he said, I couldn't believe it, right? I was like, oh, that one? And then I was looking over his shoulder when the issue came in, and he was holding it in his hands, and he said, this is just the most beautiful cover of them all. Like, of all the Mountain Record covers. And it was this picture. Some of you will remember this, maybe. Maybe I flatter myself to think that. It's a picture, a close-up of a gray, sandy beach. And it's a close-up of, like, where the waves have gone out and left just, like, a line in the sand. It is very subtle. So it's just gray on gray. And like, yeah, I was like, okay, I'm probably missing something here. Wabi sabi. Later, Ikkyo was going to be sewing a cover for Roshi's like talks. You know, the teachers have like a cloth that wraps around their folder. And she was saying, you know, I'm going to go. She was going to the Mood, this big fabric store in the city. And she said, you know, what would he like? What should I get? And I was like, oh, my God, don't ask me. Like, we have totally different tastes. And she was like, no, help me out here. And I was like, okay, well, the one thing I can tell you is, like, this was his favorite Mountain Record cover. And I show it to her, and she takes it in. And then, wouldn't you know, she sends me photos. She's like, you're not going to believe this. She's like, I found the exact fabric of that photo cover. And I am not kidding you. He doesn't use it anymore, really. But he has this gray cloth that has, like, stitched over it in darker gray, these sort of, like, branch-like patterns. Keep an eye out for it. It was, like, amazing that she found that. And he loved it. He was like, so there you go. So our sense of control, our sense of the stability of the world, this feeling that we can like get things put in place and then be okay, that is the source of our suffering, because the world is not like that. A master called reality moment to moment, non-stop flow. Dogen Zenji says reality, impermanence, is the reality right before our eyes. And nothing is fixed, but we try to grasp it. And then while we're grasping and looking at our fist, it's just sliding right through. The beauty's just slipping through our fingers. And meanwhile, we have to massage our palm from clenching so hard. Don Szymanski, the Kudo instructor who was here last week, talked about freezing space. He talked about tension and how tension, you know, the Kudo practitioner is working to be completely free and at ease without any tension, which is what makes it a meditative practice. And he talked about that we're constantly freezing space. I thought that was so evocative, so true. Andrew Olensky, who's another Buddhist teacher, writes, Buddhism points to the disturbing fact that all nouns are arbitrary constructions. A person, place, or thing is just an idea invented to freeze the fluid flow of the world into objects that can be labeled and manipulated. Beyond and behind these snapshots we take for ourselves is a vast and unnameable process. How do we loosen our grasp? I had such a humbling experience with this in the Kudo retreat. So I participated. Kudo is Zen archery, the way of the bow. And for many, many years, Don Szymanski and his assistant instructors have been coming to the monastery. And every year I'm like, oh, that looks really cool. I'd like to do it, but it takes a lot of time and I never do it. And this time I decided I would participate. And at first I really loved it. I mean, I loved it all the way through. First, let me just tell you, I was terrible. So let's get that out of the way. Right from the giddy up, like that's where this is going. It was very, very challenging for me. And in fact, so the night before, so first you learn there are these seven coordinates. There's all this form. So if you're someone who likes form, like you're gonna love this. And I guess turns out I'm someone who likes form because I was really loving it. You do this and then you do that and you swing the thing around. And I felt like I was getting a feel for the form and I was, appreciating the tradition of the whole thing. And, I've seen the demonstrations and I've seen it go well and not so well. And so after the first day of practice, You do quite a number, you do quite a bit of learning before you actually take a shot. They call it your first shot. And so the first evening I turned to Gokhan in our cabin and I was like, I'm really anxious that my arrow's just gonna go clattering to the floor. So you take your shot right in front of the target and if all goes well, it goes thunk, right into the target. And if all doesn't go well, it clatters to the floor and it's sort of rolls around or bounces or whatever. I became very familiar with that phenomenon. And so I turned to Gokhan. I was like, I'm really worried that my arrow is going to just clatter to the floor. And he was like, that's okay. So that was really nice to hear. What I didn't say is I'm really worried that my arrow is going to go clattering to the floor 20 or 30 times, which might have felt a little different. Anyway, good that I didn't know that because I hung in there. I stuck with it. So you get yourself all lined up. And the way we were doing first shot is that each instructor was working with a person one-on-one. And so you'd go through all the coordinates and then you'd get to the critical juncture
where you're like, your thing is drawn, and they'd like adjust you and be like, turn your hand this way and move this, and okay, get your tip down. They'd like try and like work it all out so that when you released, your arrow would go right into the target. And so mine didn't, and then I did it again, and it didn't again. And then I got another chance the first day to try, and it also didn't go in. And I said to Lucy, who was working with me at that moment, I was like, what am I doing wrong? And she's like, you need to relax. And I was like, really? She's like, yeah, you're so tense. And then she imitated me. And she like did an imitation of like how tense I was drawing the bow. And I was like, whoa, okay. And I could feel like once she did it, and I like felt in my own body, I was like, oh yeah, you're right. That's totally what I was doing. Okay, got it, relax. So I was like working, you know, with like, okay, I'm gonna relax, thinking that. We had, you know, rest of the evening practice, so on and so forth. And then the next day, those of us who were having trouble worked with Don Szymanski so he could like tutor us, the master. They brought in the master for the special cases. So I was one of those. And if I recall correctly, I tried once or twice more with Don, still clatter, clatter, clatter. And you know, meanwhile, this is kind of building, because like everybody else seems to be doing it fine. And Ken-san goes to me, he's like, Shoan, I would have thought you'd be kind of good at this. He's like, okay, glad to disprove your assumptions, at your service. So then I try again with Don. And this time, Don is like speaking very gently, and he's like, actually, he like steps back, so he's not like moving my hands, he's not like tweaking this or that, he just steps back, he's like, I'm gonna let you do this. And he like sits in his chair, and then he's like, just talk, okay, shoulders, okay, relax. And you know, draw it, push, okay, relax. And he's being so quiet and soft, and each time he says, relax, I can like feel in my body, okay, relax. And I can feel like more and more of the tension just like dropping out. It becomes very, very light. And then I have the whole thing lined up, and he says, okay, release. And I release, and fuck. And I felt in that moment, I was like, oh. You know, the form of it made sense in that kind of internal, embodied way. Like if you've ever had a service position and then you relax into it and you're like, oh, I'm the attendant. I'm offering the incense. That's what's happening now. It's sort of like all of it, instead of being outside, you're like right in it and it's like just clear. And what I remember, too, is that it felt so improbable. It was so not what I had in mind. It was so relaxed when it actually happened that there was no holding. It seemed like a setup for failure, except that it was really interesting. After that, it was clatter, clatter, clatter the rest of the time. But anyway, I felt like I had a really interesting experience. I definitely felt like I tasted like why people do kudo for sure. And then I also felt like it was a big teaching because I saw like, oh, you know, I thought like, okay, I know how to relax, but it's not like that. You know, and I was tense, I'll admit it. I had a rough week, things were coming up for me. I was definitely holding things in my body. I couldn't just drop it. The wisdom of the body is all there in our body. You can't fake it. And so when we're practicing Zazen and we're practicing, this is enough, and releasing and being present, that's got to come all the way down to ourselves or all the way up. You can start with your body. Sometimes that's a really great place actually to settle and to settle the mind, is to attune to your posture and feel where are you holding.
And can you gently, gently, gently relax? Okay, relax. Relax. That freezing of space. It's like when Lucy imitated me. You know, oh, you're doing, I saw, oh my God, I'm so tense. We have to see that we're freezing space. And even though that can be really uncomfortable, it's gotta happen, I think. In my experience, it seems that way. And the Zen master Bobby Rhodes, who's from a Korean lineage, and I apologize because I'm forgetting and I did not write down her Korean Dharma name. But she talks about checking, making, and holding, and that these are, in their school, it sounds like they use this quite frequently as in speaking about like how does the mind freeze things, basically. And checking is like, when something happens and then like you like look and look again and your thoughts kind of proliferate around it. Like you're checking, you check yourself, you check outside. So it's like, you know, first the arrow just goes clattering to the ground. And then I'm like, ooh, like, why did that happen? Did anybody see? Like, what are other people doing? Like, maybe I'm no good at this. How come he's doing it better? Like that's checking. And then making is like you take that and you turn it into something. Like, wow, I'm no good at kudo. Or wow, Riley's really a natural. He was, by the way. And that belief can become bigger and bigger and bigger. And then holding is then you maintain that over time. So weeks, months, years go by. I'm no good. I'm too stressed out. I'll never be able to. It becomes part of our identity. And so the best way to learn to unfreeze and to thaw out is to practice accepting what is. Instead of holding it at bay, to be with what is. Byron Katie says, when you become a lover of what is, the war is over. Take that in. So life turns out to be the real teacher. You know, the teacher in the interview room is really just helping us to see that life is the real teacher, helping us to meet our life, to not turn away, to not be deceived by our frozen state. And maybe you've had that experience where sometimes the freeze melts right there in the Doksan or Daisan room. And I was thinking about how much of the teaching is just the teacher's very relaxed and receptive presence. This relaxed and wide open presence, from it, anything can manifest. That's why spontaneity is often brought out in Zen stories or valued. It's not just for spontaneity's sake. It's because you're in the flow. You're not frozen. You can just respond. There's a very amusing little anecdote. Ryokan, who is a Japanese hermit poet, who's really known for his haiku and for being like a very eccentric figure. He lived maybe a couple hundred or 300-ish years ago.
and stories of his anecdote, of his, you know, his behaviors and so on and so forth have been passed down. And this, I don't know why, this one really charmed me. So Ryokan was at a tea ceremony. This appears, I was looking through a book of his poetry for like wabi-sabi haiku, and there were many, but then in the back, there was a section called anecdotes, and so I was looking through those, and they were quite, some of them were quite whimsical. Anyway, this one, talk about like relaxed and just like free and easy. Ryokan was at a tea ceremony, and he like very indiscreetly like reached up into his nose to like pick a booger. And he had the booger, and he like very indiscreetly went to like wipe it to the right of him. And like the next guest was sitting to the right of him and like saw what he was doing and was like, uh-uh, no. So he like stopped, and then he like went to like wipe the booger to the left. And the guest sitting to the left of him was like, no, stop. And so having no place to put his booger, he put it back in his nose. This complete immersion, it's such an important part of our practice and our training, and it's such an important part of Sesshin, and it is such an important part of residency. And you know, when I think about my very first year of residency back when I was in my early 20s, I don't remember a lot actually about like what my Dharma attainment was like during that year, but I know that I learned really big time the Zen teaching of like put yourself completely into it. And that is an extremely powerful thing to learn. We may not actually get that other places. You know, not picking, not choosing, not I'll take this, I don't want to do that, just the whole thing, that's the deal. That's the deal. And I see this all the time in the residence. And it's like so inspiring and so beautiful. And you know, when you come here to the monastery and you like have a feeling about the place and you feel like, oh, it like feels good. Like that's what you're feeling. You're feeling the practice of the people that live here. It's not a retreat center, right? You know that. This place is not a retreat center. It's a monastery. And monos means one thing. One thing. And that one thing is your heart mind. I was coming from the Sangha house this morning at the end of caretaking. And like people are like mowing the lawn and like fixing the stone path. And there's like all of this like full, wholehearted activity. It was so beautiful. The beauty of the world is enough. Just look and see. And so as we clarify our life, as we clarify this quenching of the thirst, this opening to what is, we kind of see more and more that like the thirst is already quenched. From a certain perspective, there's no thirst. That whole idea is a creation of our mind. A couple nights ago, just walking down to the office building, I saw, as I know some of you did too, this beautiful black bear cub. Inky black fur, and this languid, loping gait. And then a little bit later, right at the stairs to the office, I saw a stick bug. So it is a feast. We are at a feast. Just the way the weather has shifted this week, cool and chilly, fall coming, not to be missed, not to be missed.
Thanks for listening. You can find more Dharma Talks, interviews, and events at zmm.org/media. While online, please check out the Jizo Project, our multifaceted initiative to make Zen Mountain Monastery more accessible and welcoming to all. Learn about the new Jizo House building and accessibility enhancements to existing facilities that are just two aspects to this exciting endeavor. Find out more and see how you can get involved at zmm.org/JizoProject. That's JizoProject.